Chapter 22, Fragmentation of the Movement. The emergence of the Austro-Libertarian movement in America reached its high point in the year 1956. 10 years of continuous expansion ushered in a torrent of important publications and other breakthroughs. In 1955, Hans Senholz published his first book. In early 1956, his wife Mary edited a Festschrift für Mises that documented the Austro-Libertarian network of intellectuals. Mises himself published The Anti-Capitalistic Mentality and gave the opening address at the 1956 Mont Pèlerin Society meeting in Berlin on the permanent inflation. Also in 1956, Murray Rothbard received his PhD in economics from Columbia University, and Senholz obtained his first position at Grove City College. 1956 was also the year when Mises began to receive outward signs of recognition. Unlike several of his friends and colleagues, such as Hans Kelsen and Joseph Schumpeter, Mises had never been fortunate enough to receive prizes, honorary doctorates, prestigious positions, and influence in politics. He had spent his life swimming against the tide, and by now he probably did not even expect the applause of his contemporaries. In 1937, the Vienna Commerce sought to have Mises promoted to the rank of a Hofrat or Courts Councillor, the highest rank attainable for non-political appointees among the Austrian civil servants, but Hitler's takeover prevented this. Mises then had to wait until he was almost 75 to receive public recognition. In June 1956, he was accorded a $15,000 William Volcker Distinguished Service Award. A year later, he received an honorary doctorate from Grove City College, and other honors followed over the next few years. The most lasting sign of the veneration that Mises enjoyed in those days is the bronze bust that George Kötter arranged to be made also in 1956. Recognition for lifetime achievement is usually accompanied by a winding down. So it was in the case of Mises and of the movement he inspired in the 1950s. In personal public appearances, he began to feel his age. He had never been an orator, but had always been impressive, especially in smaller settings, for his encompassing knowledge of the subject and for his lucid and systematic exposition. This flame shone for the last time at the Princeton Mont Pèlerin Society meeting in 1958 and in a series of lectures he gave in Buenos Aires in 1959. Thereafter, his frailty weighed ever more heavily. Already in 1956-1957, he had not felt well for many months. In May, at the end of the academic year, he looked forward to spending a long vacation in Austria and Switzerland. He was increasingly hard of hearing and was soon unable to conduct seminar discussions without the assistance of Percy Graves. It was at this point that a strategic weakness of the burgeoning Austro-Libertarian movement began to be felt quite painfully, the age gap. Between the almost octogenarian Mises and his major 30-something disciples, Senholz, Rothbard and Kerzner in particular, there was no intermediate generation to take leadership from Mises' faltering hands. Henry Hazlitt and Leonard Reed were the right age, but were thought of as mere popularizers of the ideas of others. They lacked the authority to lead what was, after all, an intellectual movement. Mary Senholz had argued that Reed was underestimated as an intellectual figure. The libertarian movement now came under the influence of those who were already intellectual authorities, and in the prime age for leadership, but not really Misesians in the Austro-Libertarian sense. By the early 1960s, Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman, and Ayn Rand had acquired solid reputations as writers and were ready for national recognition as the leaders of an intellectual movement. It was due to their unrivaled impact that in the 1960s, Austro-Libertarianism came to be largely supplanted by other libertarian and conservative movements. The most visible signs of this paradigm shift were the displacement of the Freeman by National Review, established in 1955, the takeover of the Mont Pèlerin Society by Chicago school neoliberals in the 1960s, and the emergence of an organized Randian or objectivist movement. All this occurred while American mass opinion was being converted to the gospel of interventionism and socialism. Mises must have been shocked about the results of a survey among American high school seniors, as reported in a 1955 letter to the editor of the Wall Street Journal. Asked about their attitudes toward free enterprise, 82% said they did not believe that there was business competition in the United States, 60% said owners received too much profit, 76% believed owners got most of the gains from new machinery, 55% championed the postulate, from each according to ability, to each according to needs. 61% rejected the profit motive as the driving force of the economic system, and 60% said workers should not produce all they could. Austro-libertarianism simmered on a low flame for the next two decades. It lingered as an underground movement centered around Hans Senholz, Murray Rothbard, and starting in the 1970s, also around Israel Kürzner and Ludwig Lachmann. The movement was further weakened through internal strife. The most important disagreement concerned the anarchy question. Is a minimal state necessary to preserve a free society? The Rothbardian anarchists rejected the state entirely, claiming that its protection and contract enforcement functions were, like all other services, better served by free market competition than government monopoly. This stance cost them the support of the classical liberal groups around Leonard Reed and Hans Senholz, who advocated minimal state or monarchist solutions. Yet, the coherence and radicalism of Rothbard's views attracted many of the brightest young minds, and when Austro-libertarianism re-emerged as a powerful intellectual force in the 1980s and 90s, with the Ludwig von Mises Institute at its epicenter, it did so under the intellectual leadership of Murray Rothbard. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, Mises witnessed the rise of an American conservative mass movement and of the neoliberal Chicago school within the Mont Pelerin Society. He saw some of his most promising students abandon their support for free enterprise. Conservative movement and libertarian remnant. By the mid-1950s, the Freeman had accomplished its goal of rallying the disparate libertarian forces, the remnant, as Albert J. Nock would call them. Yet its financial and organizational difficulties had opened the gates for another non-leftist periodical which would consolidate the forces on the American right from a far less libertarian point of view than the Freeman. National Review burst onto the American scene in the fall of 1955. Its driving force was the young editor-in-chief William F. Buckley, Jr., a Yale graduate with a strong anti-communist pedigree. During his studies, he had gathered information on professors and fellow students for the FBI. Buckley absorbed the editorial talent that was unable to find a home at the Freeman, in particular Suzanne La Follette and William Henry Chamberlain, but also such men as Russell Kirk, Frank Meyer, Max Eastman, and Eric von Kuhnert-Lenin. When Buckley announced National Review as frankly conservative, old-world men such as Mises must have thought that, frankly, Buckley did not know what he was talking about. Mises did contribute a few pieces in the course of the first few years of National Review's existence, but on more than one occasion he emphasized the difference between libertarianism and conservatism. In response to birthday greetings in 1957, he wrote, "Unfortunately, this cannot be changed. I am a surviving contemporary of Karl Marx, Wilhelm I, and Horatio Alger. In short, a paleo-liberal, paleo-liberala." In October 1954, Mises declined an invitation from Yale University to participate in a series called Conservative Lectures, which was promoted with the promise that each lecturer will work consciously to a restoration of the power of the word conservative. He noted that the word conservative had no political roots in America, and that in Europe it meant the very opposite of the principles for which America stood. To conserve means to preserve what exists. It is an empty program. It is merely negative, rejecting any change. To conserve what exists is in present-day America tantamount to preserving those laws and institutions that the New Deal and the Fair Deal have bequeathed to the nation. The sudden emergence of the word conservative highlighted a more general unease of the counter-revolutionary forces in the United States. They were quite sure what they were against: communism, fascism, socialism, the New Deal, the Fair Deal, etc. But what did they stand for? The fact is that even in the leadership of the new movement, economic knowledge and staunch libertarian convictions were rare. The recourse to words like conservatism reflected a widespread unease about adopting any clear positive message. It was easier to be evasive than to state clearly that at the center of the new movement's agenda stood the principle of private property. Other terms started floating around too, such as limited government, federalism, and decentralization. When Mises emphasized in a paper the crucial importance of an independent judicial apparatus that protects the individual and his property against any violator, whether king or common robber, the secretary of the Erhard Foundation wondered whether this might not be too radical. After all, judges in the United States were all appointed and paid by the government. Mises replied that the American judges were independent insofar as they could not be removed or prosecuted, even if their decisions were not palatable to the executive. In contrast, the insistence on limited government was at best useful in the present-day American fight against the attempts to make the government step-by-step totalitarian. Mises went on, "But there is no doubt that outside of this special field, this term is meaningless, as it does not indicate in what regard the government ought to be limited. Union bosses could, for instance, refer to this slogan to justify non-interference on the part of the government whenever strikers commit acts of violence, sabotage, etc. It was therefore of vital importance that one advocate clearly the supremacy of private property and its offshoots, capitalism and the market economy. Insistence on federalism and decentralization would not do. Decentralization on a federal basis gives in itself no guarantee that freedom will be preserved. Medieval feudalism had both decentralization and federalism, but only the lords were free and tax-exempt. Burghers and peasants had to endure legal disabilities, had no share in the government, and had alone to pay taxes. These were very good reasons not to use the label conservative for the new American movement that rejected communism, socialism, the New Deal, and the emerging anti-market mentality of the ever more statist mainstream. But the die was cast. 4 years after the establishment of National Review, the label conservative held the public arena. By that time, at the latest, Mises must have outlived the optimism he had felt in the early days of the Freeman. He reverted to the pessimistic outlook that had become almost second nature. When his student George Reisman said he had the impression that the laissez-faire liberals were growing in numbers, Mises replied that this was the natural impression of a person who was still in the process of getting to know the other scattered individuals of the remnant. Such a person might think there are ever more individuals to share his views, because he comes to know ever more such individuals. But Mises believed that the growth was only in personal acquaintance and not in absolute numbers. On another occasion he commented that his writings were like the Dead Sea Scrolls that someone would find 1,000 years from now. But pessimism did not prevent Mises from fighting the good fight, and from encouraging others to be strong in the battle of ideas. In a letter to Hayek, who had also vigorously rejected the label of conservative, Mises wrote, "I completely agree with your rejection of conservatism. In his book Up from Liberalism, Buckley, as a person of fine and educated man, has clearly defined his standpoint. Conservatism is the tacit acknowledgement that all that is finally important in human experience is behind us, that the crucial explorations have been undertaken, and that it is given to man to know what are the great truths that emerged from them. Whatever is to come cannot outweigh the importance to man of what has gone before. Origenes, Augustinus, and Thomas Aquinas have said the same thing in other words. It is a sad truth that this program is more attractive than everything that has been said about liberty and about the idealistic and materialistic benefits of the free economy." What were the reasons for this sad truth? Mises felt there was here an unexplored question, he went on. "I assume that you, just as I, do not write to console yourself with the proverb, Dixi et salvavi anima meam, I have spoken and thus saved my soul. Hence there is the question, how is it possible that the elite of our contemporaries is absolutely clueless vis-à-vis all these things? How does it come, for example, that the sugar price policy of the American government is hardly ever contested, even though out of 500 or 1,000 voters, there is at most one who can expect advantages from an institutionally increased sugar price? The problem I have in mind is not the behaviour of the mass of intellectuals and of those who count themselves among the intellectuals. I mean those authors, both fiction and non-fiction, who, for example, speak about affluence and simultaneously about an overpopulation that brings mankind close to starvation. Or the Civil Liberties Union, which on the one hand moves heaven and earth when it finds that a tennis club admits Negroes to its courts only as guests but denies the membership, but which declares, on the other hand, that it is no civil right to work without a union card." Demise of the Cirque Bastia. The only work that matched Human Action as a literary monument to the libertarian renaissance of the early post-war period was Ayn Rand's novel Atlas Shrugged. Mises was a great admirer of this work and said so in a letter to its author. Atlas Shrugged is not merely a novel. It is also, or may I say first of all, a cogent analysis of the evils that plague our society, a substantiated rejection of the ideology of our self-styled intellectuals, and a pitiless unmasking of the insincerity of the policies adopted by governments and political parties. It is a devastating exposure of the moral cannibals, the gigolos of science, and of the academic prattle of the makers of the anti-industrial revolution. You have the courage to tell the masses what no politician told them. You are inferior, and all the improvements in your conditions which you simply take for granted you owe to the effort of men who are better than you. If this is arrogance, as some of your critics observed, it still is the truth that had to be said in this age of the welfare state. Before he read Atlas Shrugged, Mises had not counted Ayn Rand among the foremost contemporary artists and philosophers. In the original Rand circle in Manhattan, and in many of the later Randian groups throughout the United States, many members cultivated a religious reverence for the writings and opinions of Ayn Rand. Their attitude to Rand's writings did not differ essentially from the attitude that Christians hold toward the Bible, and consequently, they were in more than one respect the acolytes of a Randian church. Rothbard, who had personally attended the meetings of Rand's group for several months, stated that the fanaticism with which they worship Rand and Brandon has to be seen to be believed, the whole atmosphere being a kind of combination of religious cult and a Trotskyite cell. They demanded unconditional allegiance to their creed and harassed and ousted anyone who would not go along with the party line. One position of the creed particularly dear to these Randians was atheism, the religious belief in the non-existence of God. For Ayn Rand and her disciples, it had always been a matter of course to contest any evidence purporting to prove the existence of God, and to emphasize any argument or piece of evidence that was deemed to prove his non-existence. But this argumentative approach was chosen only when they confronted neophytes. With more senior members of the group, they felt they could expect a more mature stance on the God question, the unconditional adoption of atheism. And they did not forgive deviance. In particular, they would not tolerate an avowed Christian in their midst, and even went so far as to harass members who, although atheists or agnostics themselves, were married to unrepentant Christians. This was the case with Murray Rothbard, whose wife Joanne was unapologetically Protestant. One might argue that the Randian insistence on action in conformity with its atheistic ideal was a healthy attitude to preserve and cultivate purism, and indeed, from this point of view, Randianism might be as legitimate as any other religion. It was, however, not the attitude that Murray Rothbard brought to his encounters with fellow human beings. He had a firm opinion on various questions, but he was mainly interested in argument and debate as the best method to test positions and opinions. When it became obvious that he preferred being married to Joanne to being numbered among the Randians, things turned ugly. In early summer 1958, Rothbard was asked to abandon his theistic wife. He refused to comply. This incident had direct repercussions on the Austro-Libertarian movement, in that it led to the disintegration of the Cercle Bastia, the Misesian study group that met at Murray Rothbard's apartment and had included Hessen, Ligio, Rako, and Reisman. Hessen and Reisman remained in the Randian orbit and had no further contact with their former friends, who had in their view betrayed reason. Rothbard, in turn, pulled no punches about what he came to call the Ayn Rand cult. He later had telephone shouting matches with Nathaniel Brandon, a man who took pride in outdoing everyone else in worshipping his mistress, in both connotations. Brandon charged Rothbard with plagiarism and threatened him with a lawsuit alleging that Rothbard in a recent paper had adopted ideas from Ayn Rand and Brandon's wife Barbara without duly acknowledging this intellectual debt. The charge was baseless. It cost Rothbard's friend Leonard Ligio only a couple of hours of work in a public library to document that the stolen ideas had been part of the Western intellectual heritage for several centuries and had originated in many cases with Catholic scholastic thinkers. Mises had taken part in the symposium on relativism at which Rothbard had presented the original version of the paper under dispute. The symposium took place in 1959 at Emory University. The Volcker Fund sponsored it. Helmut Schoeck, a professor of sociology at Emory, organized the event, Schuck also wrote the most scathing indictment of the charges made against Rothbard. About Rand and Barbara Brandon, he said, "They clearly suffer from a serious case of what Sorokin, Fads and Foibles, calls the discoverer's complex. They seem to think that they, the female innovators of unique ideas, were robbed by a bad male." Mises was speechless at the Randian's charge of plagiarism against Rothbard, but he avoided any direct involvement in the controversy, which he was sure would resolve itself in Rothbard's favour. Mises had good reason not to create even more bad blood between his disciples and the Randians. At the beginning of the 1960s, Brandon's organization was very successful in selling Mises' writings, in particular Planning for Freedom. At the end of 1961, the book was almost sold out, and Niemeyer planned an extended second edition, including an additional essay. Another organization that was very successful in selling Mises' books was the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists. Ayn Rand and Nathaniel Brandon also tried to establish closer ties with Mises, inviting him to attend their lecture evenings and social gatherings. Mises reciprocated to a certain extent. He appreciated intellectual affinities with the Randians, but he was not fond of their fanatical zeal. He liked to persuade other people through detached speech and writing, whereas the Randians strove to make converts to the cause of objectivism by applying the same techniques used by religious cults, group sessions, psychoanalysis, and group pressure. Mises could perfectly well respect and even befriend people with whom he disagreed, even when these disagreements concerned questions of fundamental importance. This was the case, for example, with Louis Auger, a positivist, Gottfried von Habeler, an interventionist, Louise Sommer, a protectionist, and Murray Rothbard, an anarchist. It goes without saying that he did not avoid socializing with honest socialists. Cases in point were the Bauers until their fallout with Mises in 1919, as well as his critic Karl Landauer, whom he probably met in 1952 at Berkeley, and he wrote letters of recommendation for interventionist professors. Leland Jaeger, a monetarist, once wrote to Mises, "I hope you agree that among people who are united in favor of economic liberalism, there can be a healthy controversy on such details as the admissibility of the price level concept and whether the gold standard or price level stabilization is the better rule for monetary policy." And this hope was entirely justified, despite the fact that Jaeger's disagreements with Mises concerned more than mere details. Mises would not hold anyone in low esteem just because the person in question held opinions that Mises believed were entirely wrong. Steeped in the humanism of the Christian Occident, he held the individual above anything else. He was not concerned about individual souls, of course, but he did care supremely about individual liberty. He was happy for each new convert to the cause of liberty, but he would have been unable to rejoice over conversions obtained through group pressure and other forms of harassment. For Mises, only one sin was unforgivable: lack of integrity. Speaking and behaving against one's better knowledge could not be excused. This is why Mises maintained a lifelong friendship with Gottfried Habeler, whom he believed to be an honest interventionist, but broke with Fritz Machloup when he started qualifying the case for the gold standard. At the same time, Mises recommended Leland Jaeger for Mont Pelerin Society stipends, even though Jaeger was no less skeptical of gold money than Machloup. But the Randian mind was not overly concerned with the trifling virtue of integrity. There was only reason, always capitalized, and whoever did not come to endorse reason as defined by the Ayn Rand Church had to be stupid, evil, or hard of hearing. Being friends with such a person was out of the question. The Randian way of dealing with disagreements was to confront the dissenter with a stark choice: either undergo an endless series of discussions with the foregone conclusion that the dissenter had fallen prey to the heresy of irrationalism, or be expelled from the group and shunned by all its members. In the fall of 1961, Nathaniel Brandon showed once again that bullying his opponents was his forte. The New Individualist Review, a journal edited by Ralph Rako, who was by then a doctoral student in Chicago under Hayek, had published a critical piece on Ayn Rand. This prompted Brandon to ask Hayek, who was on the editorial board of the review, publicly to dissociate himself from the author of the article and to insist an apology to Miss Rand be printed in the New Individualist Review on your behalf and in your name. He also sent a copy of the letter to Mises, who was certainly happy to have kept the Randians at arm's length. Of course, Hayek never complied. Mises abhorred such bullying. He had a different way of dealing with smears. In the fall of 1961, Mises and Rand met at a party in Henry Hazlitt's house. It was not their first personal meeting. They also met in early July 1961, and they discussed the problems which we both consider as vital. It is possible they stayed in touch in the 1960s. In June 1970, Mises promised his Mexican friend Velasco that he would talk to her about him and his work. After dinner, a discussion between them turned into an argument on philosophical principle and drew the attention of the bystanders. It is not clear what was said, even though there were a number of topics on which they heartily disagreed. For example, Mises did not believe that scientific value theory could establish an objective ranking of choice alternatives. He also had recently asserted in print that the essence of art and beauty is that which pleases. On the other hand, he certainly did agree with Rand's writings in most other respects. In correspondence with Muthesius, he said that Ayn Rand was the most energetic opponent of antitrust policy. In any case, Russell Kirk, a notorious critic of Randianism, who had witnessed the discussion, was later reported to have said in his lectures before student audiences that Mises had called Ayn Rand a silly little Jew girl. When the report was brought to Mises' attention, he immediately wrote to Kirk, "I never called Mrs. Ayn Rand, or for that matter anyone else, a silly little Jew girl. I should be obliged if you would not repeat this false story in the future." Kirk denied it all. "Your informant, with the eccentricity and fanaticism characteristic of the Randian cult, seems to have combined details from several accounts of the meeting between yourself and Miss Rand, which he had heard, and to have attributed the composite story to me. Any anti-Jewish prejudice or suggestion thereof was not contained in my second-hand account, nor in the account which I heard, but I'm glad to have from Mr. Hazlitt a more accurate report of the encounter before receiving your letter." Against the neoliberals. The Mont Pelerin Society had begun as an ecumenical undertaking, bringing together purebred liberals of the classical tradition and neoliberals, who endorsed interventionist schemes to one degree or another. From the beginning, Mises had been skeptical about the ecumenical concept, but for the first 5 or 6 years, his apprehensions seemed unwarranted, even though the organization of all Mont Pelerin activities lay in the hands of a devout neoliberal, Alfred Hunort from Switzerland, who Mises had first met at the 1928 Zurich meeting of the Verein für Sozialpolitik. An admirer of Rothe's serfdom, Hunold had been among those who encouraged Hayek to convene the foundational meeting of the society at Mont Pelerin, and he had also raised substantial funds for the event. At this meeting, the ambitious Hunold was elected secretary of the society, but after a few years, he was no longer satisfied with his position under Hayek. His long-term goal was to become Mont Pelerin society president. His strategy was to make himself irreplaceable. He dealt with the smallest details of organization, and by the mid-1950s started to handle correspondence without consulting Hayek, who resented these encroachments from a man he did not exactly love in the first place. After 1956, the conflict between the two men grew more intense and eventually came to a clash that brought the society to the verge of dissolution. In the early years, this clash was barely visible. With the support of Hunold and others, the neoliberals steadily increased their numbers, but they did not dominate the society. The main reason was probably that although Hunold had financial backing in the Swiss business community, he could not match the funds that were mobilized on the other side of the Atlantic. Hayek, Mises, and a few other classical liberals had a primordial impact on the selection of topics to be discussed. On the one hand, this was due to their scientific pedigree. On the other, they enjoyed substantial financial backing from the Volcker Fund and from individuals such as Niemeyer, Greed, and Crane. At least until the end of 1953, the Volcker Fund paid the membership fees and often also covered travel expenditure for virtually all non-US members of the Mont Pelerin Society. And the fund was eager to accommodate Mises' wishes, and probably Hayek's wishes also, when it came to securing financially the presence of certain members at the meetings. For example, when Mises declared that he would not attend the 1954 meeting in Venice because of insufficient French and British participation, the Volcker Fund asked him to handpick the beneficiaries of financial assistance in order of their relative importance. Mises named among the French economists 1. Louis Boudin, 2. Daniel Villet, 3. François Trévoux. and 4 Bertrand de Jouvenel. Among the British, 1 Dukes, 2 Plant, and 3 Denison, as well as the Irishman Duncan. Mises did not attend the Venice meeting because he had to undergo gallbladder surgery. 2 years later, he approved the funding of Coase, Nutter, Alkin, Philbrook, and Jaeger. At the end of that first phase of the history of the Mont Pelerin Society, therefore, the leadership around Hayek was far more radically libertarian than most of the regular members, especially those from Europe. The coexistence within the Mont Pelerin Society of groups with such different orientations was well known by its members. It was also fairly obvious even for newcomers. A case in point was Jean-Pierre Amelius, a young professor of business and economics in Luxembourg, whom Mises knew through correspondence. At that point, Amelius was 29 years old. Amelius had recently discovered the literature of classical liberalism, which he devoured and translated into French and German. Mises had him invited for the 1953 Mont Pelerin Society meeting in Zeelisberg. He also suggested invitations for Fertig, Courtney, and Niemeyer. These 3 men were admitted as new members in a council meeting of Hayek, Rappin, Itta, Mises, and Hunold. Hamelius immediately noticed that the society was divided along the lines of ideological orientation and language into different groups and clans. He himself felt closest affinities to the American group of Mises, Hayek, Hazlitt, Morley, Fertig, and Miller. From the other participants, who did not know that he had gotten his invitation through Mises, he heard reservations about the old guard, Mises, Hayek, who were sometimes called the old conservatives. The young professor from Luxembourg was eagerly taking notes and discussing the interventionist schemes of various members who were not yet part of the old guard. Thus, John von Sickle proposed taxing rich heirs. Wilhelm Röpke favored subsidies for homeowners, and Otto Weit argued that heavy taxation would not deter entrepreneurs from working. Ludwig Erhard, fresh from the victory of his party in the 1953 elections in Germany, also gave a talk at the meeting. Hamelius' report shed light on the change of relative weights within the society that resulted from the apparent success of Ludwig Erhard's neoliberal policies in Germany, the so-called Wirtschaftswunder, or economic miracle. To the socialists and social democrats who dominated the climate of mainstream economic opinion at the time, it was truly miraculous that the abolition of price controls and the transition from a centrally planned economy to a market economy would yield substantial economic benefits. For unrepentant classical liberals such as Mises, there was no miracle at all. But Erhard's success was problematic because it gave unwarranted credentials to his middle-of-the-road philosophy. This also applied to his closest advisers, who were often referred to as champions of the social market economy or leaders of the Ordo School of Economics, his Under-Secretary of State Müller-Amack, and the professors Wilhelm Röpke, Geneva, Alexander Rüstow, Heidelberg, and Walter Eucken, Freiburg. In short, the success of Erhard's initial classical liberal policies was used to vindicate subsequent interventionist policies, in particular antitrust laws and inflation. Even before the war, Mises did not have the highest opinion of most German economists. After his emigration, he had avoided any closer involvement with them. He would acknowledge Erhard's achievements by contributing to a Festschrift in Erhard's honor, but he declined to write an entry for the new standard social science dictionary, the Handwörterbuch der Sozialwissenschaften. Only after Gottfried Habler pleaded a case of the editors did Mises agree to write a piece on economic liberalism, a complement to Hayek's article on political liberalism. His contribution was eventually published under the title Market. He delivered the work before the end of March 1955. The publishers improved his article after having received the proof pages from him. And the prospect of cooperating with a fashionable Ordo school, be it in the Mont Pelerin Society or elsewhere, did not exactly warm his heart either. He believed the Ordo people were hardly better than the socialists he had fought all his life. In fact, he eventually called them the Ordo interventionists. It must be said, however, that he supported them whenever common ground could be found. Thus, in June 1950, he recommended the translation of Röpke's textbook Die Lehre von der Wirtschaft to the University of Chicago Press. And his New York associates seem to have harbored essentially the same views, but without Mises' hesitation to express such views in print. There were classical liberals in Germany who opposed the interventionist excesses of the Erhard ministry and the Ordo school, the leaders of the laissez-faire group were Volkmar Muthesius and Hans Hellwig. Muthesius, who was based in Frankfurt am Main, ran two successful journals, Zeitschrift für das gesamte Kreditwesen and Monatsblätter für freiheitliche Wirtschaftspolitik. But they could do no more than fight an honorable rearguard action. Being denied professorships at the universities, their foremost means of action was Muthesius's journal, to which Mises contributed several articles. Hellwig wrote to Mises, "Men such as Erhard, and maybe even more so Professor Ristorf, have strictly speaking not much to do with classical liberalism. Earlier classical liberals would have made no bones calling them social democrats. They would not have called them even social liberals or socialists of the chair." Hellwig had expressed such views in published writings from 1955 onwards. In a piece for Muthesius's journal, he had argued that antitrust policies were counterproductive and that the champions of such policies, most notably Eucken, Miksch and Böhm, could therefore not properly be called classical liberals. Moreover, he had the indelicacy to point out that Böhm's and Miksch's monographs had been published in the Nazi era and could only have been published at the time because the Nazis did not perceive neoliberalism as a fundamental threat. On the contrary, quite a few of them took a liking to the idea of government imprinting its order on competition. Hellwig knew what he was talking about. He had been a Berlin-based journalist during those very years. But Walter Eugen's widow Edith and Wilhelm Röpke protested with great vehemence and recrimination to Muthesius for publishing such politically incorrect views. Mises sided with Muthesius. Mises replied, "I have no illusions about the true character of the politics and politicians of the social market economy. Erhard's teacher, Franz Oppenheimer, taught more or less the new frontier line of President Kennedy's Harvard consultants, Schlesinger, Galbraith, etc." Mises also knew well the pro-inflationist views of Erhard's Undersecretary of the Economy, Alfred Müller-Armack. In 1932, Müller-Armack had published a book amplifying the case for inflation presented by Joseph Schumpeter. He had argued that credit expansion had the character of a self-fulfilling anticipation of growth. But because of the near-total ignorance of foreign languages, Mises explained, the American public had a very unrealistic notion about what the German social market model stood for. The only issue of German politics included in the American debate was the monetary policy of the German Central Bank, which was much less inflationary than the policies of the U.S. Federal Reserve. Thus, the ruling class in Germany was perceived as devoted to classical liberal principles, such as sound money and international trade. Erhard's success changed the Mont Pelerin society, sweeping in the very themes Mises had stressed should be excluded, such as the need for antitrust and the possible virtues of credit expansion. On both issues, Mises sided with Volkmar Muthesius, who argued that the best way to combat monopolies was to abolish the policies and government institutions that created them in the first place. Mises was especially wary of yet another round of discussions of antitrust laws. In his youth, he had witnessed the anti-cartel agitation that followed their rise in the 1890s. At the time, the debate had been propelled by the Verein für Sozialpolitik, which was always seeking a new rationale for more interventionism. For decades now, he had not come across new arguments on either side, and he expected that any debate in the Mont Pelerin society would quickly turn to an interventionist agenda, rather than addressing the main case of present-day monopoly prices, the U.S. price policies for agricultural products. It was probably due to his influence that the topic did not appear until the 1956 Mont Pelerin Society meeting in Berlin, by which point many German professorial members had urged Hayek to set the monopoly question on the program. The issue could no longer be avoided. The meeting fully confirmed Mises' expectations. A few months later he wrote, "I hope that this year's Mont Pelerin meeting will be more interesting than the Berlin meeting." Goodrich Company, Indiana Telephone Corporation, issued annual report highlighting the consequences of the ongoing inflation for the American economy and for corporate accounting, the problem of illusory profits. Mises liked them very much and urged Goodrich to seek wider circulation of his message. It turned out to be the overture for some 5 years of internal struggle for the Mont Pelerin Society. A few months later, Hayek tried to mobilize his allies to attend the next meeting in Saint-Moritz, 1957, which he felt would be decisive for the future of the society, but to no avail. Personal tensions between Hayek and Hunold became obvious in the following year, which for the first time brought a Mont Pelerin Society meeting to the United States, to Princeton. In the early 1950s, the American libertarians tried to hold a Mont Pelerin Society meeting in the United States, but for financial reasons, the Europeans had no money. This project materialized only in 1958, when Jasper Crane managed the fundraising. The outbreak of tensions at the Princeton meeting is stated in Hunor Turupke in a letter dated April 4, 1960. About that time, Mises, a student from his Geneva years, Stefan Pozzoni, had difficulties being accepted in the society. The Princeton meeting was positively memorable, however, in that Mises here delivered one of his last lectures to the Mont Pelerin Society on the subject of liberty and property. The topic had been suggested by Hayek, who was desperate to organize something like a debate on fundamental questions among the members of the society. All his previous attempts had ended in a fiasco, as he himself recognized. But Mises rose to one of his last great public appearances. His talk survives as a tape recording and testifies to the fact that he was still at the height of his powers. The printed version of the lecture has remained one of the best concise expositions of the case for classical liberalism. During the next 3 years, the conflict between Hayek and his recalcitrant secretary lurked beneath the surface. Hayek could not get substantial support to oust Hunot. Most American members were on Hayek's side, but feared that an open conflict would destroy the society. It eventually came to a showdown at the Kassel meeting in 1960. Hunold presented his view on the events before the Kassel meeting in a letter to Röpke dated April 4, 1960, a copy of which he also sent to Mises. Hayek then declared in another open letter dated July 3, 1960, that Hunold's replacement as secretary of the society would be the most important task of the forthcoming general meeting. After careful examination of the evidence, Röpke became more and more convinced that several of Hayek's charges against Hunold were baseless, and that, on the contrary, Hayek himself had occasionally overstepped the bounds of his authority. Hunold, in turn, believed that Hayek had come under the bad influence of Mahlup and others, Friedman, who sought to abuse the society for their personal purposes. After the Turin meeting, member Wolfgang Friedhofer concurred he had the impression that a group around Friedman had poisoned the atmosphere with intrigue and pettiness. In early January 1962, Bruno Leoni presented his negative experiences with Röpke and Hunold in an open letter to all Mont Pelerin Society members. And he went into more ugly detail in a confidential letter to Kötter, which of course reached Mises. Both Hayek and Hunold stepped down from their positions, but Hunold would become vice president of the society and wreak havoc for a while longer. The 1961 meeting was to celebrate Mises' 80th birthday, but Hunold turned it into yet another battle between neoliberalism and laissez-faire. The ordo-liberals would soon be pushed into the background for a while. The power vacuum was not to be filled with Austro-libertarians, but economists from the Chicago School.